Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island change procrastination in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which apparently, according to the Prime Minister John Key, who used to work for the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, is good for the economy because now everybody can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guests are known only as Ezra. I don't know the details of this, so we're going to find out. Guys, welcome to the program, and welcome, and also welcome your gargantuan Pharaoh's hat.
Thanks for having us on, man. Appreciate it.
Yes, nice to see you, Vinny.
Cool, man. Now, tell us your names and who you are, what you do, that kind of thing.
Sure. I'm Steve Woolner. I basically hosted the Labyrinth of the Psychonaut channel for the past 4 years, doing videos on synchronicity, spirituality, metaphysics, vortex mathematics, all things that basically lead to the ultimate question of who we are, what we're here, why are we alive and breathing, what is consciousness, and I'm very humbly trying to bridge those categories as much as that I can.
While wearing a gigantic Pharaoh's sunray hat.
Yes, yes. I find no difference between me and the Pharaohs of old at all, other than I live in a society that's completely ridiculous now.
And you haven't had your brains removed through your nose by an iron hook.
That's true, too. That's very true.
Cool. And yeah, and I'll introduce myself then too. My name's Ezra, and Ezra Sanzerbell is my full name. And Steve and I have been collaborating on videos together since 2007. I think actually you've been doing the Soundless Dawn channel for more than 4 years, probably like 6 years
or
something.
Yeah, you're right.
And yeah, we met back in 2007. I have my own website, Tone Color Alchemy is the name of the business. And I teach music theory through the lens of basically, you could say like a system of tarot and astrology that was formulated by Paul Foster Case back in the early 30s. And so basically, it teaches people music theory, color theory, and the basic archetypes of the tarot all at the same time.
All right. Well, what exactly does that mean if you're teaching people music theory in relation to color and so on and so forth? I don't understand this yet.
Okay. Sure. I'd be happy to explain that. Basically, the way that it works, if you understand music theory, the roots of music, where the instruments that we play today, where they came from, you'll come to understand that they have these very ancient roots, at least into Greek hermeneutics and probably earlier into the Chinese system of music theory, which was before equal temperament ever existed. So you have a history of Western music typically goes back to about 1750 with Johann Sebastian Bach. And before that, you had the Renaissance period, and before that, monastic chant. And basically, the roots of our music is religious. If you look at church music, if you look at monks singing in monasteries, that's where our music came out of. So what I've tried to do in my work as somebody who went to school and studied music theory academically, I'm trying to bridge the gap between alternative history, mysticism, and magic with music theory. And I've found a couple of key characters along the way who have allowed me to bridge that without having to make any leaps of the imagination. That all of the information is out there, readily available for people. I'm happy to go into the details of that, but that's where it's coming
Please
from.
Please do.
Sure. Maybe we can backtrack a little bit before we just jump into that, because the reason, you know, we're on the show right now is we're promoting a project called Music Myth Cosmos, which is it's a documentary series that we're creating right now, and we're asking for support from our subscribers on YouTube on our channel. And basically, the premise of it, you know, maybe I'll turn it over to you, Steve, if you want to describe what we're doing.
Sure, absolutely. We're basically trying to take apart all the functions of music that have affected us as children, video games, pop culture, anything that has really affected us on a very deep level. And in the Western system of music, we don't have microtones like in India and other countries. So we're trying to see where the 12-note tone system came from in Western music. And as Ezra stated, it definitely has heavy overtones of church affiliations. But Bach and all of our major composers were writing music for the church. So we're trying to figure out why certain music gets to us the way that it does and makes us experience certain brain frequencies and states of mind and emotions and everything else. And basically, we're trying to figure out why advertising and marketing companies endear certain musical attributes to children more so than others in their cartoons and their advertisements for products, everything in between, and movies and pop culture and all those attributes it combined together. And we're also looking at the magical element of it, like what makes music gets into the body, makes us feel spiritual and closer connected to the heavens and the gods and that sort of thing.
Okay, so music's been used for a very, very long time in order to, you know, I don't know, what was a friend of mine who used to make dance music say? He said he used to bang drums and run around in a fire, you know, with the little horns and stuff like that, pretending to be bulls or beasts or something like that, work yourself into a frenzy, and African tribes still do that to this day. And I'm wondering, what are the scientific bases behind these musical rituals and these transformations and things of that nature that they do in, say, drumming circles?
Well, some of it is cosmological. A lot of it is. If you look at Galileo, the scientist that was pivotal in changing the heliocentric model to the model that we have today with
the geocentric model, right?
Exactly. Where the planets are spinning around the sun as they are today. That his father, Vincente Galileo, was also pivotal in bringing the 12-tone system to Western music. And so there is a strong tie to astronomy, strong tie to the music and the heavens and the stars. In fact, they're one of the same, if you ask me. It's the macro representation of what the musicians and the stars today are doing. And that basically is going around all around us at all times. And it's that kind of interpretation that we have as human beings that we take from the inspiration from the heavens and we make the music into what it is today.
So this would be why in New Zealand, pretty much every time there's a full moon, you'll see people are out in drumming circles in the middle of the night.
Right. And I want to add something too, Vincent. As far as like the ancient shamanic tribal cultures where you had people going to ecstatic trance through drumming, one of the most interesting things we have as far as like you were asking for scientific evidence as to why that works, we have what are called binaural beats. Are you familiar with those?
No.
Okay, so I was
beaten up by two people at the same time. Warren, I don't think that's related,
That's almost the same thing, I think.
Right. So the way binaural beats work, they're an entrainment process, a brainwave entrainment process. They're designed so that if you put on headphones, you have in one speaker, let's say a frequency of 400 hertz, and in the other. In the other speaker, you'll have 404 hertz. So there's this slight difference. Hertz, by the way, is a measurement of cycles per second in frequency. So this slight difference will actually create a sort of like a dissonance, a cognitive dissonance, which ends up generating a third waveform, which is the difference between them. So if we have 404 hertz and 400 hertz, the difference is 4 hertz. And so by putting those two speakers on simultaneously, within the brain, the third brainwave is created, which is that 4 hertz frequency, and that can have certain effects in terms of your cognitive abilities, your relaxation, your ability to study, and so forth. So in a similar way, when an individual bangs on a drum in a repetitive pattern for long periods of time, our brainwave states are actually entrained, and we go into a kind of hypnotic trance, and that would be the perfect time to then contact the spirits.
Right. So, have you guys contacted any of the spirits in the midst of your musical abodes here?
I would say that, you know, in my practice, like, music has just been a tie to the otherworldliness. Maybe not a direct presence of God, but in these imperfect forms, we make music to try to mimic pure sound, which is, you know, Genesis is like, in the beginning there was the word, that first original sound that created all the stars in the heavens, earth, all the sentience in the entire universe. As imperfect beings, we pick up, you know, primitive tools sometimes. We pick up sticks and lutes and whatever we could bang on, whatever, bongo drums, and we try to imitate what that original sound was. And maybe we don't really think that we're giving homage to that original sound, but that's what we're doing in practice. We're just trying to get back to the very root, the very soul existence of what we are as human beings, that pure consciousness. And we're not terribly good at it. Even our most savant geniuses, you know, conductors and orchestrators that have produced incredible, incredible sonnets are still not approaching it. We're just flailing like little monkey boys that have been alive for, you know, a few thousand years and have only evolved a little bit. And we're trying to reproduce this song of the heavens. And it's so beautiful and so humbling that we're trying it. And the more that we progress through this and the more that we understand the correlation between music and physics and harmonics and gravitation and magnetics and all these things that bind the universe together, the better our music becomes. And it's a very slow process, but it's such a fun one to undertake.
Well, if that's the case, I also wonder about sound pollution, because I've always thought to myself, you know, it really sucks to have cars rushing past you all the time, these big trucks and everything lumbering down. There's nothing melodic about that. I wonder if there's something that's bad that comes out of it, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm open to that. I mean, there's the classic discussion of what's the difference between noise and music. And there was a lot of composers in the late 20th century and even into today that are in this sort of avant-garde experimental edges of culture who are trying to bring in noise and chaos as a way of extending and expanding our parameters of what's listenable, what's acceptable, what we can integrate and still have like a functional, healthy human organism.
I once heard a song by an artist named 16-Bit called Chainsaw Calligraphy, where he uses chainsaw sounds as dance music.
That's funny. You know, actually, I was just watching that David Attenborough documentary called The World is Song or something to that effect. And one of the birds that they talk about in that documentary, the whole documentary is about music and how Earth and nature inspires human creative faculties, including and especially related to music. And he talks about bird songs. And there's this one bird that in order to call in his mate, he will first fluff out his feathers and do a little dance and then begins replicating every single bird in the forest. And at a certain point, David Attenborough is with his cameraman recording this bird, and you hear the bird make this terrifying sound, and you're like, oh my god, it sounds like a chainsaw. And then the narrative voice comes in and says, yes, this is actually the sound of chainsaws cutting down trees. The bird has even learned how to mimic that sound.
Yeah, it's an evolutionary mechanism, so it can survive. It's survival of the fittest, and the animals of nature use those tones and those microtones to either be predators or to just avoid predators and to survive
and to own. Attract a mate. In this case, this is a mating ritual, right?
Yeah, so it has, like what I'm doing with my hat right now, this is a form of peacocking. So ladies, look at my little hat. Yeah.
No, he's taken.
Yeah, well, there's nothing sexier than chainsaw sounds, I must say. You know, that really gets my juices flowing.
It's a good thing to do on a first date, is to bring out the chainsaw.
You want to sharpen my blades, baby?
Well, see, so, and this is interesting as well, because what if we're unwittingly and this is a great example here. We're unwittingly bringing new noise and new sounds into the natural world, you know, just through trying to destroy it. We're actually changing it.
This is true. I mean, it starts out with the heartbeat, right? The original rhythm when we're in the womb, when we're just a fetus, and our heartbeat syncs with the rhythm of cosmos and all time. And basically, we just kind of flounder the rest of our lives trying to mimic that original vibe. And like, some people wonder why they have certain anxieties and they're not syncing up with certain elements in their life. And it's because like we have all these deviations, and like you said, noise pollution, certain environmental elements that take us out of that original feeling of being just being, you know, not trying to be something, just being. And I think pure sound, the attempt at pure sound is an attempt at just that, because there are audiophiles across the world. They just need a good set of headphones and some, you know, wonderful Mozart or Bach or Beethoven, and they can sit there, and whether or not they attain that sort of monk Buddha state of like complete zero mind is indifferent. It's irrelevant to that process. We're learning from that, and we're enriching our souls and our experience on this planet by experiencing those things and having that time alone away from noise pollution if you can. Because, you know, my girlfriend and I, we go in nature sometimes, we go on hikes, and we cup our ears and we just listen to the sound of the rain. We listen to the sound of the rainforest. And there's nothing better than that to get you centered and grounded. There really is nothing to differentiate from a beautiful orchestra, in my opinion, a beautiful symphony. And that's what I'm talking about. That is what pure sound is. You don't need instruments. You just need to listen to Mother Earth and all of the instruments that she provides around us. And we can mimic that with our instrumentation, and that's a lot of fun. But the true essence of it is something that's much more internal and much more specific to the human being.
Well, sound, resonant frequencies. There's three things that came up to me when you're saying that. One, there's some dude in Romania who plays classical music to his grapevines, and they produce really amazing wine. Also, there's insects and all the noise that they make, you know, like crickets, cicadas and things like that. They found like sometimes if those particular animals get wiped out and the sound's no longer there, the plants stop growing properly or they don't germinate properly or something like that. And also there's about what noise makes you comfortable and what allows you to go to sleep and things like this. And I remember this TV show, I forget what the hell it was or how long ago it was, but there's this girl from New York City. She moves into this college that's like in a small town and stuff like that. And she goes, oh man, all this silence, I'm never going to be able to sleep. So she's got a tape recorder full of New York City sounds, like people saying, I'm walking here. And you know, it just depends what you're comfortable with. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but unless it's real dark and real quiet, I can't freaking sleep.
Oh, I'm with you there.
Yeah. We'll be right back after the break at the Vinnie Eastwood Show .com. Ezra and Steve are my guests. We'll be right back.
On December 16th, 1961, the world turned upside down, then inside out, and I was born screaming in America. It was the tail end of the American dream, just before we lost our innocence irrevocably, when the TV eye brought the horror of our lives into our homes for all to see. I was told when I grew up I could be anything I wanted. A fireman, a policeman, a doctor, even president it seemed. And for the first time in the history of mankind, something new called an astronaut. But like many kids growing up on a steady diet of Westerns, I always wanted to be the cowboy hero. That lone voice in the wilderness, fighting corruption and evil wherever I found it, and standing for freedom, truth, and justice. And in my heart of hearts, I still track the remnants of that dream wherever I go in my never-ending ride into the setting sun.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go frickin' nuts. My very special guests, Ezra Zera and Steve Wilner. Welcome back, guys. We were talking there before about what kind of sounds are good for sleep and all of that kind of stuff, and that actually makes me wonder about frequencies and about sleep itself and how important it is. And I've seen people with these go to sleep meditation CDs and things of this nature. I was wondering if there's any actual basis to that, you know? If you're going to sleep, listening to some kind of a far off, you know, bird sound like caw-caw, and then it'll just like somehow soothe your brain places while you're slumbering.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well, I wanted to also tie in your question just now, also with what you said right before the break, which is there's this, you know, there's been a lot of studies actually done on the relationship between sound, nature, and just healing in general for the human organism, because we're so dissociated from our natural environment as, like, especially as urban shamans, where we just live in the city, we're surrounded by concrete and buildings and cars and electromagnetic frequencies bombarding us from every angle between Wi-Fi and cell phones and the whole deal, that when we get out into nature, I mean, it's been my experience as somebody who oscillates between the urban and the rural as like different lifestyles. I've lived on farms where I'm living in a tent, and even if it's just one night in a tent, the next morning I'm up at 7 a.m., whereas like usually I can't even get myself out of bed until like 10 a.m., and that's so much to do with just the comfort of the bed and the comfort of this isolated space that's cut off from the rest of the planet, apparently, and that's all an illusion. I mean, the thing is, our separateness is totally an illusion, but it's reinforced by these boxes that we live in.
Sure, there's a hibernation sickness that comes with living in a big city, where you're just like this big mushy creature who just wants all the comforts he can because he has it at his beck and call. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in these very, very pristine environments where everything is like given to us, and we can just get delivery of our food, delivery of everything, and we're like as you said, we're bombarded with RF. We're bombarded when we sit in front of the computer all day. So when we do go into nature and we get those really good ions and we get all those beautiful nature sounds, it brings us back down to earth. It grounds us literally. So like, you know, when we were kids and you get grounded, you're punished. But really, being grounded is what we want. We want to put our feet in the earth. We want to reconnect with the earth and get away from all these, you know, sound pollution devices.
Mm-hmm. And even devices. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
If you're going out in the city, you're surrounded by negative morons. Whereas what you really want is positive ions.
Positive ions. Well, I think actually negative. I think negative ions are supposed to be the stuff that comes off waterfalls. Like negative ion generators are actually like this this healing technology that's come out over the last 50 years. I don't know about positive ions, but I know for sure negative ions are.
Well, it's a symbiotic relationship between us and nature, us and plants. We give out oxygen. You know, carbon dioxide, they give that oxygen. So standing next to a rainforest, you're going to get all of these positive electrons or positive ions.
The negative ions.
Negative ions, into your system. And that basically makes you symbiotic with the earth. And it, in my opinion, rids you of a lot of the things that ail you. A lot of the plagues that you suffer from can be cured by just staying around those elements for a long period of time. And, you know, they've done studies, was Dan Winter? Mm-hmm. He's done studies of like native tribes that basically build their homes next to seawater, where they're getting this negative ion thrust into their thatched, you know, straw created structures. They live very simply, like Native Americans, and they don't have any modern medicine. But a lot of their elders are living to their, you know, after their hundreds, 110 years old, without any kind of medicine whatsoever. And it's because, in my opinion, and many others, they live close to these environments that are closer to pure sound, away from RF, mm-hmm. away from all of this stuff.
Right, and also,
I would say that's actually due to the fact that the poisons are actually more. Medications are more along the lines of poisons in Western culture anyway, and so they probably live longer because they don't have that Western medication to deliberately poison and kill them.
Yeah, is there anything in the Western world that doesn't create a dependency? Think about it. Think about the food that you eat, the air that you breathe, your entertainment. I mean, the government, everything. We have dependencies on the very smallest things. Like if you have a cold, you're to go to the store and buy a thing of nose spray. The nose spray fixes your problem instantaneously. Except what they don't say is that you have an addiction to the nose spray afterwards. And this is a synthetic chemical thing that you keep having to use to reproduce that same feeling. And that's the nature of the human being, is that we're habituated to everything that we experience.
Right. But then I also want to throw in the other voice that you have, you know, this alternative culture that's shown up in the U.S., especially over the last 50 years with the, you know, beginning of the 60s and onward, where you have like a return to nature, the whole raw food and living food communities, yoga centers and meditation and all this stuff from all these wisdom traditions that have coalesced, especially on the West Coast, in my opinion, just from having experienced like a lot of different areas of the United States. I know that, you know, that this stuff is available everywhere, but especially having lived in the Midwest and the East Coast for a period of time, the West Coast is really special in that in California, Oregon, Washington, we have access to incredible amounts of organic food and medicine that's not just like this addictive pharmaceutical slop, but it's actually like, yeah, there you can get goji berries and hanza berries and cacao, and you can get mesquite and maca and whatever. You can just get all these amazing superfoods, and then you can get access to the technology you need to ground. You know, but the issue with that, I mean, if you could call that like the counterculture of the new age in the 21st century, the problem with that alternative raw food, living food culture is that you have to have a bunch of cash. I mean, if you can't afford this really expensive organic food and all the like healing technologies that come with it, what are your alternatives? And that's where I come back to sound. Having gone through a lot of different phases of this question of like how to be a healthy human being in American culture in the 21st century, sound is one of the major keys. And the reason I come to that is that music is this amazing healing modality where I've met people who are just totally entrenched in, you name it, drinking beer and smoking cigarettes and watching television and all that stuff. And they even work jobs 9 to 5 that they don't like. But if they have music in their life, there's something that they access where through that creative impulse, they're able to express the energy of God and of harmony and of cosmos that can come through them from their innermost all the way outward into expression. And through the reflection of seeing this piece of music they've created, they can have the awareness that they're not actually separate from God or separate from the whole cosmos, the totality. And I feel like that the awareness of that is so healing, it can almost overpower like all the other adversaries to a point. I mean, music isn't like the panacea, but it does have an incredible healing potential.
Wanda, exactly what kind of healing potential? I mean, are there experiments with low frequency sound where they'll be able to like kill a cancer cell or something like that?
Well, you know, you have like ultra low frequencies that can cause people to shit their pants too. Excuse my language, but yeah,
you can't use that language on FCC regulated radio, bro.
Right. Oh wow. Right. That's totally inappropriate. Excuse me. So yeah, but to you know, to have like these to have these low frequencies that can cause like, you know, sickness and disturbance, or but also like these binaural frequencies that can cause, you know, this incredible like hemispheric synchronization and this ability to just be connected to our totality. And so there's these different, that's why I say it's a potential for sound healing, because if you, you know, as an individual step into music with the intention to heal yourself, that's an option. But if you step in with just the intention to experiment, you might encounter healing and destructive frequencies. And that's part of what we go into in our work, is that music has not just the power to heal, but the power to destroy. And it's really up to the individual to do what they will.
Yeah, music has all the same elements as the universe itself presents. The black hole sucks in all matter, all stardust into it, and shoots out somewhere else in another quasi-universe, white matter, into another quadrant altogether. And I mean, basically, we can use those and harness those abilities in ourselves as musicians to create or destroy. Have you ever heard of holophonic sound, Vinny?
No.
Well, we're bihemispheral organisms. We have a left and right hemisphere, and then we have the corpus callosum that separates the two bridges of the brain. And holophonic sound is a way to trick the brain into seeing visual identities, much like your 3D paintings where you have to stare at it for a long time to see the 3D image within. There's ways to embed and incorporate visual cues into music that take a visual form. If you were to close your eyes and something was recorded with holophonic sound, you would get a very primitive image of what you were looking at. So that's the very tip of the iceberg of what we can produce with different tones. We could actually tell stories. We could have subliminals in there that will reach us in our sleep state, in our dream states, that really go beyond, above and beyond just pure listening enjoyment. It can shape us as a human being, and possibly without our know-how or with our knowledge that's going into it. Preferably with it, obviously, but you know, advertisement companies and marketing have obviously known about this technology for a long time. Disney and all of these Masonic corporations, they've been adding that to their movies for over a century now, over 100 years, you know, and the technology like keeps growing.
Like what movies? Could you cite an example?
Well, I mean, the first thing that comes up, just because we incorporated imagery of this into our most recent video, was in Fantasia, when you have Mickey Mouse and he's like put on the sorcerer's cap and all of a sudden he's conducting the waves. So he's like, he's got this hat on, he's got a conductor's wand, and he's pulling the waves up with his will. But you see it all over, you know, all over the media, where you have these magic flutes that are able to open up dimensional doorways and portals, or
they have one of those in Prometheus when he fired up the alien computer using a flute.
Exactly, and that struck a lot of chords in our deep
so to
history
speak.
And origins. Yeah, so to speak, exactly. I mean, that's what we like to brush on, is like, if that's in pop culture, that ancient astronaut theory, that these precursors of mankind use sonic tones as a means to produce a Stargate, to travel from point A to point B from long distances, and to go around the Einsteinian theory of Einstein-Rosen bridges, and to use vibration or harmonics in a way that bends space-time. I understand there's no like solid science on that currently, but every bone and intuition in my body tells me that you could use sonic simulation and gravitation to move an object from point A to point B without using fossil fuels. I'm almost certain to it, to a point, and we don't integrate that technology in the world today. But I'm certain it could be done.
Well, guess what would happen to all the oil companies if suddenly nobody had to? Guess what would happen to all the car manufacturers? Yeah. Guess what would happen to all the shipping companies? Everything in this world seems to revolve around transportation of something from getting to A to B. And if you cut out the fracking middleman, I reckon that would be way, way, way more awesome.
It really has to do with the variable of time. If music is time, and as we present in our video series, you could look at a musical note as energy and movement that's trapped in place, frozen in time. We can look at music as a device to transport a vehicle, a vessel, a human being, a planet even, a star even. from one point of the universe to the other without using any time at all. That's what the real magic of music to me at a core level means. But do we have the technology to pragmatically use that yet? No, we're still learning about that, you know, and very, very rapidly doing so. I just think that in the future we'll be able to use that as a means for all kinds of transportation.
Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be really cool if you do like a sci-fi movie where there's some genius composers or something like that in a band, and they manage to like work the frequency in their music up to such a point that they can actually teleport from one side of the stage to the other or something like that, and the whole crowd goes, yeah!
if you look at the simple constructs, like how light goes through a prism and it creates every light band of the spectrum, and you look at all the different frequencies that microtonal musicians use in India and in Eastern countries, you can see that they're almost like coordinates, and they represent every possible visible and audio wave band that we can possibly perceive as human beings. So why couldn't we integrate that with, you know, quantum physics and people that are creating wormholes in CERN and things like that, and use it to create stargates into any kind of perceivable future that we can? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I want to just piggyback on that and say, well, okay, in the meantime, we don't have that technology publicly accessible yet. We don't even know when we were talking about music and sound, we're talking about air particles bouncing up against each other, right? So we're just talking about the most simple sort of waveform. And that, I mean, when you're talking about any kind of military device, they even have these ultra loud projected devices that are used in the military. For example, if there's an airship that's like traveling over the seas and they detect what is suspected to be like a pirate ship, in other words, a ship that's been hijacking other ships and stealing the goods. This still happens today. I mean, there's been, you know, in certain areas of the world, there's like the pirates are actually like a significant problem. And that one of the technologies they use is this directed energy weapon. And it's actually based with audio, where you're able to send a focalized point of sound towards a coordinate. So, for example, if they see somebody who's manning the ship, they can direct a sound beam at that individual, where other people at the ship might not even be able to hear them. And that sound that they're projecting could be on a low volume or a high volume, and it can be any sound that they want. And so they can use it first to communicate, and then if that doesn't work, they can use it as actually a torture device to cause people to just hear these unbearable sound, you know, sound frequencies in their skull that other people can't even hear, and it causes them to look or appear crazy, etc. There's all sorts of ways.
I've suddenly found a positive use for Britney Spears albums.
Oh no! But
use it to torture pirates.
Use it to torture pirates. I love it.
Oh, I did it again.
Well, it's not uncommon, actually, for pop music to be used as a torture device in the Middle East. Not sure if you're familiar with that, but with waterboarding and all of that.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. But my friend James Wright, who once got strapped to a chair in a mental asylum, he's exposing Freemasonry, biggest whistleblower like in a long time. We'll be right back.
Sacrifice young children in order to make very youthful baths indeed. My very special guests is Ezra Zira and Steve Wilner. Then we got Indiegogo.com and ToneColorAlchemy.com. I happen to be them very nice websites indeed. Welcome back from the break, my friend.
Thanks, Benny. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Benny. We're enjoying talking to you.
Well, I hope to enjoy that. And in fact, there was something that occurred to me over the break. What the hell is it about this show that makes people feel as comfortable enough to swear on?
I think it's just your affable personality.
It happens all the time. It's like, oh, it's Vinny, let's say the S word, let's say the F word, you know? I don't know.
Oh, it's part of our freedoms, I guess.
Totally, yeah, right. Part of our freedoms. Oh, yes. Thank you, the dreaded FCC. you know, think of the FCC as kind of like this broadcast version of the dreaded Osaka flu. this horrific broadcasting virus kind of thing that takes people's complaints and goes out and stops people from speaking freely in the land of the free that has guaranteed free speech.
Totally. Wow. You know, I wanted to clarify something too. You mentioned our websites. One of them is tonecoloralchemy.com, but the other one may be more relevant. The Indiegogo website, the name of the project is Music, Myth, Cosmos. And you can also find that if you go to YouTube and you look up Music, Myth, Cosmos, you'll find the trailer there.
All right. You'll find the trailer there. And you'll also find lots of trailers in Alabama. Apparently.
what we want to do, Vinny, is we want to fundraise so we can take some of these videos and do a lot more live footage and footage that we shoot personally ourselves and make it a more standardized documentary format where we cover everything from, you know, the origins and roots of Western tonality and music to where we are today to everything that we talked about before. And even the sci-fi factions of our conversation. Like, there's a thing called sonoluminescence. If you type in Google search Bubblegate, you'll see that there are dozens of very, very intelligent scientists that have been using implosion technology, fusion technology, to implode sound waves in water to create bursts of light. And basically they could create millions, billions of these little tiny bubbles of light within a medium that could and very well will power our vehicles and spaceships in the future without having any exhaust or any pollutants as a byproduct. So that's just the tip of the iceberg, what we're talking about as far as how music affects consciousness, how it's going to affect us as vehicles, and how it's going to affect our transportation and our economy in the future as well.
Well, as a young man, I have a great lack of patience, and nothing happens fast enough, as far as I see it. You know what I'm saying? You know, you hear about the scumbaggery of the controlling the world, the big evil Rockefeller oil cartels, the illegal wars and stuff like that. Sure, they wrap up eventually, but why not do it now? The one thing that really ticks me off about the news is that every other news story seems to be, oh, a new cancer cure drug has been found or something like that. And they advertise it and they say, oh, it's going to be really good. And then that drug never winds up getting past the testing phases and never winds up getting out to the public. Kind of like when we're talking about free energy technology, oh, it exists, it's there, it's working, and it never gets out to the public. If it works, we don't really get access to it. If it's beneficial, it's taken away from us. If it's scumbaggery, on the other hand, it is promoted like there is no frickin' tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. It makes you really think of, like, as a species, or at least as in my personal experience, I've always felt a little bit quarantined on the Earth. I feel like we're segregated off from the rest of the enormous universe throughout, you know, like it's just staggering. It's you can't even represent it in your mind how many different Earth-like worlds there are that have been around for more hundreds of millions of years, more longer than Earth. So there's this feeling of like there's this like isolated gem in the solar system and this weird tendril quadrant of the Milky Way called Earth, and we're just floating around, segmented and detached from the rest of the possibility that there's a sentience all around us. And then we have all of these obstacles to like grow as human beings that push us, things that, like, you know, take us out of our human element, and sickness and disease and hatred and cancer and death and all those things. It's almost as if they're like a high watermark for us to rise to the occasion to, or to completely give into and let that sickness and negativity take us. And I feel like there's going to be some kind of tipping point. I understand you have no patience, neither do I. I'm a young man too. But I just feel like there's going to be some kind of tipping point where we achieve this level of humanity where we're no longer violent and we're no longer taking our nuclear arsenals into space and poisons and everything else. And in that time, if there are other species, if there are other sentients in the universe, we'll be accepted into some kind of galactic brotherhood in which this is just a normal thing. I almost feel like our evolution can't be messed with. Like, we're not ready to be told certain things. We're not ready to be incorporated into this larger family yet, because we are so brutal and because we are so mentally ill in some ways. But there's no reason why we can't escape from that. And maybe music and studying of the cosmology and our history in that way will be a vital tool that gets us there as a society, as a world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the other scale that I'm thinking of is like it goes from the impatience of youth to the being jaded of older life. And I think the disconnect in between there is not seeing achievements and not affecting achievements on your own course. Because what people do, is, and I believe this is the biggest frickin' mistake of the entire human race, is they expect somebody else to do it. You know, you come up with a great idea like, oh, my God, that's a brilliant idea. Ah, somebody else probably already thought of it. Oh, somebody else has already come up with it. Yeah. And they don't even bother to search whether or not somebody's done it. And the likelihood is if you've come up with a really great, brilliant idea, sure, there might have been somebody else who's done it or thought of it. But I think that if you keep coming up with ideas and if you keep applying them, eventually you really start to change things. And even if you don't change anything, the fact that you're doing something that's different to everybody else changes you and stops you from becoming jaded.
I think every religion in the world tells you that you can't make your own luck. You should just rely on faith and prayer alone. And I think that's maybe what segregates me personally from the New Age movement is that I do feel like you make your own luck. You can't just allow for this set path of faith to dictate what you're going to do for your whole life and sit back and be lethargic and have no movement, have no energy behind your actions, have no willpower or intent behind your actions. And I think maybe that's one of the greatest things that will happen in the next 1,000 years when we evolve away from some of those archaic medieval ideas is that we'll re-empower ourselves to realize that we are a creator God species. Every single one of us is capable of writing a symphony, a movie, a play, a book, anything. We can create things from absolutely not had existing before. And I think a lot of the world religions kind of just say, well, you don't have to really use that creative attribute. You could just be a very left-brain engineering person who does the same thing every single day and creates these manufactured products that are not good for your health or anybody else's health. And you don't have to really act as the creator acts. You could just be a cog in the wheel, so to speak. And I think that we're hopefully evolving away from that, or at least integrating both of those ideals at the same time so that we're not so heavy on one side or the other.
Yeah, I mean, well, if you want to do something really, really good, you don't get from point A really bad to point B really, really good. It's not an instantaneous thing. It takes time and work and progress and evolution as we're talking about here. And so you think about how bad a situation that we're currently in. But then again, I'm talking globally here. You know, financial, health, etc., all are in decline. And so then you have a look at all of these other possibilities that are actually out there, people who have really come up with great inventions to solve all of these problems, just like, bam, you know, tomorrow if we had the will, we could do it. And instead of people going, you know, I'm going to go help that person who's got this piece of technology that could save the world, they say, oh, he's not working hard enough. You should do more. And it's just like, oh, come on, bro, come on, you know. People need help out there. What's his name? Sterling Allen from PezWiki.com, the free energy Wikipedia, and a couple of other guys that I hooked him up with are trying to start out these community projects to actually get money and advertisers and sponsors for these inventors and manufacturers of free energy devices, because they don't have the marketing skills, they don't have the armies of followers and things of that nature to help them do all these things. And that's, I think, when people really, really start to fire on all cylinders, is when they've got a team behind them.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's so true for us. I mean, right now we're launching this Indiegogo campaign, and we've been making videos for 6 or 7 years. We've got 26,000 subscribers on our channel. We get all positive feedback essentially on our YouTube channel, and yet we've gotten like maybe 10 or 15 donations, and it's not like because we haven't put effort in, but it's just I feel like the market is so saturated with self-starters and entrepreneurs that there are so many people who are taking advantage of this new internet medium to try to promote themselves and get support that it's almost like it went from there isn't any platform to do that to now it's like one of the most accessible vehicles, and so everyone's doing it, and so now there may as well be no one doing it because once again you don't have access. People are just, when we reach a certain level, like a critical mass of people doing anything, we just turn off. Like I remember as a kid watching advertisements, and at a certain point I just realized all advertisements were to be ignored because there wasn't a single advertisement that wasn't just trying to steal from me. And whether that's true or not, it's just that was the attitude I took on unconsciously. Absolutely, and I think that's the same attitude a lot of people have with fundraising and promotion now. So we're trying to break through that and just let people know, you know, we're coming out with a really prime product, a really beautiful offering that offers this technology of consciousness that's going to open us up to the next phase of evolution of our planet and of our tribe, and you know, in whatever way we can be of service to that.
We get to decide what that is. Not the big wigs, not the old timers that are phasing out now. We get to decide that.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back after the break. Steve Wellner and Ezra Zera are my guest. ToneColorAlchemy.com is one of the websites, and also Indiegogo.com. Music Myth Cosmos, I think, is the one you're supposed to be looking for on there. Back in just a few minutes, folks. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We basically only really have one rule on this show and on this network, and that is to have fun. If you're having fun, the listeners are having fun, allegedly. Also, needed to remind listeners that your support is the reason why this show exists. In no small form, it's literally that, okay? Advertisers, hit and miss every now and again. Very few products get sold. But what does happen is that people will subscribe for a few dollars a month to get the Vinnie Eastwood Show commercial-free archives. And also, some people are donating about $20 a month to keep the lights on and the heat burning and so on and so forth. Coming into winter now in New Zealand, this house has got really high ceilings. It's fracking cold. I need a new pair of slippers. All right, basically that's what I need badly. It's a pretty rough existence, yo. New Zealand construction methods have not improved since the early pioneering days that much. Okay, and in fact, it's almost as if. They've employed Scotsmen to construct all the houses in order to insulate the cold so as to remind them of home. It's just that terrible. But conveniently, I have a number of jackets that have been donated to me over the years that are relatively warm and fluffy. Now, speaking of which, if you want to donate to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, there is a bank account for automatic payments on the homepage, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in, go ahead, make my news. So get on in there, or if you are capable, just get go for the PayPal, you know, a one-off donation would be lovely, or a monthly subscription of some size, ranging from $1 to $100 a month, whichever you can afford. And nobody so far has been able to afford $100 a month. The show's not that good. All right. My very special guests, Steve Wellner and Ezra Zera, welcome back. I was wondering where you would like to take the conversation now.
Wow, there's so many different ways we could go. You know, right now we're promoting this Music Myth Cosmos series, which we're also, you know, asking for donations and so forth. And maybe we can just give some more context as to the specifics of what we're doing in that documentary series.
Go for it.
Just to kind of come from my own background, I have a website called Tone Color Alchemy, and what I do there, I have these 6-week courses that I teach the fundamentals of the major arcana of the tarot. To give some background as to what that means, so you have in the standard playing deck of cards, you have what are called the pips, the ace through 10, and then you have the royal cards, the jack, queen, king. And There's a little bit of a difference between these cards and the tarot cards in that in the tarot, all of the cards you would see in a 52-card deck, those are all called the minor arcana, and there's 4 additional cards. So there's 56 cards in that minor arcana, but there's a whole other segment, which is called the major arcana, and that's composed of 22 cards. These cards could kind of be you know, you could compare them to the Joker in the sense that they don't have a number and they don't have a suit. They have their own archetypal value. However, there's these 22 different archetypes that are represented. So when I first discovered music theory and I went through this academic curriculum and got to the end of the music theory program, I realized that there was something missing from the way they were telling the story of music theory and where it came from and how it works and how it affects us as listeners. So I wanted to go even deeper, and that's where I found all of this archetypal mythology to be really relevant. So I discovered this 22-card major arcana system as a key to understanding music theory, and here's why. So for those of you who are watching the video, I actually brought a visual aid. This is called, this is actually a part of the Rose Cross Lamen. This is a basically a flower that's represented with 22 petals with a cross at the center. Now, the way that this is described by a number of different teachings in the Western Hermetic tradition is that you have at the center the three petals at the innermost center are called the mother letters, and they're said to be the mothers of the rest of the alphabet. So these three petals give birth to the middle layer, which is composed of seven petals, and finally the outer layer, which is composed of 12 petals. So when you add up the first, second, and third layers of three petals, seven petals, and 12 petals, you arrive at 22 petals, and this is the 22-petaled rose lamen. Now, those 22 petals correspond to the 22 cards of the major arcana. However, the correspondences don't end there because they also correspond to musical notes. Now, the interesting thing is that in the Western musical system, we only have 12 notes in the subdivided octave. That means that if you were to play the musical note C, and then you were to play the higher octave of that note, there are 12 notes in between there, including C, before you reach that octave. So those 12 notes are represented actually by the outer layer, which are these 12 petals. If you then go one layer in, you see these seven petals correspond with what's called a diatonic scale. So in music theory, the closest and most accessible analogy would be in The Sound of Music, that famous movie with Julie Andrews. She says, do, a deer, a female deer, re, a drop of golden sun. The whole scale is do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Everybody knows that. And if you just take the first seven, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, those correspond roughly to these seven inner petals. It's not a direct correspondence in terms of the actual tones attributed to that, but archetypally it resonates with the idea of that there's, out of these 12 different fundamental notes, you have this seven-note diatonic scale that emerges out of it. At the very center of the flower, you have the three petals, which are Aleph, Mem, and Shin, which correspond in tarot to the Fool, Judgment, and the Hanged Man, and they correspond to the musical notes C, E, and G sharp. They form a perfect triangle or an augmented fifth of the root, the major third, and the augmented fifth in music theory, for those who know the language. And what they represent is the idea of a musical chord. One of the definitions of a musical chord is that it has to be composed of at least three notes. If it's just two notes, it's a harmony, but if it's three notes, it's a chord. So the subdivision of this flower into three, seven, and 12 parts is a perfect simulacrum of the musical subdivision of the 12 chromatic notes into the seven diatonic notes into the three-note chord. So when I realized that there was this archetypal foundation that was shared between the tarot, between these Western hermetic magical orders that were using this tarot system as a foundation for their magical ritual practice, which, by the way, this is a derivative of the Golden Dawn, the hermetic order of the Golden Dawn out of Europe, out of Britain in the late 1800s, 1888.
As well as the OTO?
As well as the OTO, which is basically Aleister Crowley's derivative of the Golden Dawn, and also the BOTA, which is a hermetic order started by Paul Foster Case, not affiliated with Aleister Crowley, but it is affiliated with the hermetic order of the Golden Dawn. So if this might sound like a lot of information, but essentially what we're saying is that there are these orders of initiates in magical orders throughout the world, especially in the Western tradition, who have looked to this actual diagram as a foundation for enacting ritual practice. Which, what is the intention of those practices? Well, there's all sorts of different theories as to what the applications may be. Some of it is that it's mind control, manipulation of the masses, etc. But there's another teaching which actually, if you were to follow the text and the actual teachings of the groups themselves, this is considered to be the teachings of a Brotherhood of Light. And these different 22 petals are considered to be the 22 paths on the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. And the whole Tree of Life is seen as this diagram of the soul, as well as of the body, and the circulation of light from the very roots of our body, from our feet, all the way up to the crown, to our head. So,
like the chakra systems and so forth.
It's totally affiliated with the chakra system, which, as you know, there's essentially eight chakras. The first seven are from the root all the way up to the brow, and then the eighth chakra is the crown, which is sort of the expression of that seven chakra system. Circulating as an auric egg or a field of light emanating from the crown or the top point of our head back down through the feet and circulating like a torus. Yeah. So this is really about the liberation of our physical energies and our sexual energies through certain types of meditation and magical practice. And at a certain point, that's so empowering that one could then begin to have effects on the external world in such a way that if the will of the magician was unclean in some way, that they had this malevolent intent, the power that they've cultivated through these magical arts could then be projected out into the world as symbolism, which is then perceived by the sort of initiated masses as this Illuminati symbolism or this negative symbolism. And that's only one expression of the teachings of this order, because the other teachings, the prime teachings of this group is about light and about the cultivation of light and the cultivation of personal power.
Sure.
So how we use that power is really up to each of us individually.
Has anybody ever been arrested for cultivation?
I don't think so. Unless it was cultivating, you know, plants or something.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was referring to.
Right.
In terms of musical scales, and I was just thinking about this, in terms of therapy, are there any psychiatrists, psychologists, etc. Out there who are using tonal experimentations to see if they can relieve people of, say, mental traumas or things of that nature? Any evidence of that?
Ezra and I both used these light and sound devices that sync up binaural audio with a visual device, a little visor that has different color LEDs in the visor. And it's not unlike experiences that I've had in a float tank where you're suspended in a very saline water, where you're buoyant in water, and you close your eyes and you have sort of rapid-fire visuals in your own eyes without having any music whatsoever. But these light and sound machine devices attempt to mimic certain brainwave frequencies, beta, theta, to basically get you in the mode of getting prepared for REM sleep, or to regress your psychology back to a point in your history when you were a child. And all these things can be used with tonal devices and sound coming together. In a sense, the mediums are one and the same. The visual element and the audio element merge and create this holophonic bridge across both hemispheres of your brain, to where if you're open to the experience and you're using it as a guide for meditation and a guide for inner knowing and inner searching, you could definitely use that to search within yourself and quiet your mind and find different brain states and know how to initiate them without those tools as well. They're sort of like training wheels.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I understand that music can be very healing. I just wonder to what extent, you know.
Right. Well, that's where I wanted to also chime in. There was this guy, what was the name of the – it'll come back to me, I'm sure, at a certain point. But there was a guy who was using binaural beats. It was a guy who actually started the whole binaural beat phenomena. And I've met a couple people who actually had worked for him. The name is escaping me right now, but the whole idea was that he was like a PhD, and he was trying to figure out how the brainwave states were associated with behavior and performance, and how somebody who had gone through traumatic experience could put on a very simple, technically non-musical sound frequency device with these binaural beats and affect their brainwaves in a way that then they could perform more efficiently. And there has been a lot of scientific evidence that's an effective method, to where, I mean, I actually personally know sound therapists who their entire technique is to basically do simple hypnotic inductions through neuro-linguistic programming and basically empower individuals to believe in themselves while hearing something that's recalibrating their hemispheric patterns in a way that they come out of the therapeutic environment with a sense of self-empowerment, with a sense of that they can go into their life and perform and succeed.
You could really wormhole into the intellectual side of how audio and sonics affect consciousness and how we could use that in subliminal ways. You could probably make a mixtape for your girlfriend using a binaural audio dummy head that suggests the name Vinny over and over again when she closes her eyes. If you want to really get crazy with it, you can. But I guess what we're talking about on another side of things is that it has a lot to do with joy. When you see dolphins creating those silver rings that they can create sonically with their own sound bursts from their whatever, their third eye, their vocal cords, they create these little silver rings in the water, and they're just playing with them. They're just having fun. So, like, sure, we as human beings, we're going to sit there and intellectualize and try to understand and format all these systems to autograph what all of these things do to our mindset. But if we look at animals in nature, they're just having fun with it. They're using pure sound as a way to just experience joy. That's it. It's not complicated at all.
See, I also wonder what's the opposite side of that spectrum, because if sometimes music can make you experience joy, then certainly it can make you experience hate. Like whenever I play any of my songs to the missus, she definitely starts to experience hate, and it's an instant just she hates it and wants to shut it off. You know, I hate your music, Vinny. I hate your voice. It sucks. Turn it off.
Oh, no.
Wow. Well, you know, what comes up for me when I hear that is that there's no particular genre that's been scientifically proven to create either joy or hate. For example, if somebody has a lot of anger pent up inside, and so they're already experiencing a lot of hatred towards whoever in their environment, when they put on music that's inherently angry or hateful, that could actually create joy just because they feel that they're mirrored by something. And so that I'm not of the belief that, oh, in order to like heal through music, we have to listen to like, you know, chirping birds and binaural beats. Yeah. No, I'm just saying that music liberates energies. So whatever we're feeling internally, music can match that. And it can do it in a way where it doesn't cost it. There's no resources. I mean, electricity or something, but whatever. I mean, when you take that and you compare it to pharmaceutical drugs where there's all these negative side effects, and there's a cost of production, a cost of purchasing and all of that, music really eliminates all of that. And especially moving into the internet where there's this freedom of media, freedom of expression, music really seems to me like a free energy device of consciousness, if not literally at the level that Steve and I are both dreaming up, where, wow, someday we could literally teleport to another part of the universe with sound. Like, is that possible? Well, maybe. You know, but in the meantime, well, what about the idea of teleporting to a previous part of our own existence? So I put on a piece of music from my childhood. All of a sudden, I have the somatic knowledge of what it was like to be a 7-year-old kid experiencing that music.
And I mean, this is just an assumption, but I think human beings, because of the evolution that our brains have taken over the reptilian and the mammalian layers of the brain, music affects us different than it would affect things in direct solid nature, like plants and animals. Masamoto, the science of plants and water.
Masaru Emoto.
If you played more aggressive kind of, you know, metal or like kind of angry music towards plants, there was a study that suggested that it wouldn't grow to their fullest extent, or they would be affected at least in some way biologically from the actual negative aggressive sounds of the music.
I saw an article just the other week, a guy put out, he put some seeds down and it was some water over them so that they would germinate, and he puts one tray of seeds next to his smart meter that's putting out all these EMF frequencies and one on the other end of the house, and the one next to the smart meter didn't germinate at all.
Yeah. It's the same with microwaves.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll be right back after the break.
Germinating seeds that you've used microwaved water to.
We're coming to break. And we'll be right back to talk about more microwaves.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all the time, and 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is wrong. And they distract you. They feed you, and then they feed you some more, and then they feed you, give me a dessert. I'll do a dessert, you prick. Give me that dessert. I have a Bloody Mary, yeah, give me a whiskey sour, yeah. Give me whatever you got. Just more liquor. And then when you're done, there's still 16 hours to go.
Welcome back.
If you want to know what it's like.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand. And my very special guests, Steve Wildner and Ezra Zera. Where does the name Ezra Zera come from?
It's kind of an inside
Are you
joke,
like descended but, from an old like Faroic line of viziers? Like hence the Zero? No.
Yeah, so I think Zero would be the feminine, you know, version of Zero. But no, it's actually just a joke because my first name is embedded in my actual last name, which is Sanzerbel. Sanzerbel is a little bit difficult for people to remember, so I just kind of eliminated all the extra words and just swapped around the E and the Z, so Ezra Zero.
I think it's quite musical, though, Sanzerbel. I always like that.
Right, there's the bell, all the resonance of that. Yeah,
it sounds like some kind of the name of some form of demon, you know? like Beelzebub or Zanzibel, you know?
In fact, in order to get Ezra to get to the apartment, I had to do a little ritual and conjure him. Right. He doesn't just come through the front door. You actually have to do it.
Right, I'm just a figment of your imagination, Vinny. Yeah.
Like he materializes out of the hairy doormat or something like that. You know? he can only be summoned at certain times of the month.
That's why it's so fun hanging out with him, because I know I have a window of time I can have with him.
Yeah. You know, whenever you get chased down by the cops for smoking weed in an alley or something like that, Zanzibel just disappears behind them and like whispers in their ear and shit.
You probably haven't heard of Portland because we actually don't have police here and we don't have any laws. So Portland's one of the few cities that doesn't have any laws.
Yeah.
Do whatever you want.
That's a half truth. Yeah. Hey. You know, I wanted to share something with you though on the theme of ritual magic and all of that. If you're open. So one of the things that Steve and I were talking about during the break and we were talking with Adam was there is this really interesting relationship between music and music and sound's effect on our external environment combined with ritual practice. And I think one of the most interesting examples of that, if we go back a couple thousand years or several thousand years, is into the building of the Egyptian pyramids. So to this day, scientists are kind of baffled. They're like, how is it that the architects who built the pyramids of Giza were capable of lifting these, what, over a ton? Each stone weighs over a ton. It's just, we don't even have the machinery today to be able to actualize this monument, these three pyramids. So what's the story and how did it happen? And when I first started investigating that, one of the things I came across was this archaeologist who had field research on the topic of acoustic levitation. Now, we actually have right now, if you were to go on YouTube and type in acoustic levitation, we have scientists who have developed a form of acoustic levitation for, of course, it's funny, pharmaceutical industries. What they're doing is that they send two beams of sound, one from above and one from below, towards a focalized point. And because of the frequency they beam simultaneously, they're able to actually cause small droplets of water to hover in midair. And then they can inject pharmaceutical medications into them in order to be able to study them. So the reason I bring that up is because there is right now the phenomena of acoustic levitation is a reality. And my question, what I've always wondered is if we didn't have so many electromagnetic frequencies sort of like plaguing our planet, if we as a planet and as a race, as the human race, might be more susceptible and receptive to both planetary frequencies, but also to frequencies on this planet generated by instruments, including the human voice on this planet. And I've always wondered if part of the secret teachings of not just Freemasonry, but of all of the Egyptian mysteries out of which it's derived, if one of the secret teachings wasn't around the idea of acoustic levitation and the use of the voice to manipulate matter. And I actually am of the belief and opinion that it's possible that these giant one-ton stones used to build, both like the megalithic monuments of the pyramids of Giza, but also, let's say, Stonehenge or whatever, that they were actually manipulated through sound.
Yeah. There's a structure in South Florida near Miami, actually, I think it's Homestead, in the southern part of Florida, called Coral Castle. And it was these gigantic, even larger megalithic structures than the Egyptian pyramids. This man, Edward Lediskin, I think I'm saying his name correctly, took these pieces of coral and using techniques that he said were derived from the secrets and the mysteries of the builders of the pyramids and Freemasonry, a sacred mathematical and potentially musical system to arrange these pieces of coral rock, this little frail man who was like 5'3", weighed nothing, into his 60s, built this for the love of his life. I actually never got to see the actual structure. I actually went to Coral Castle in South Florida And there would be no way for a man of his stature and size, there'd be no way for 50 men of that stature and size to move those pieces of coral rock into the configurations that he had them in. And he built them in a way that it made it almost like astronomical, because he had them in a set up as an observatory where you would see certain, just like in Stonehenge, where you would see certain solstices and full moon rises at these precise mathematical intervals. And he used the secrets of music and mathematics to do that. The keys that Pythagoras and many other of higher initiates of Freemasonry have used for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Mm. Now, on top of that, girlfriend and I were watching a travel show. This lady goes around the world and stuff, and she's traveling down the Nile this one time on a boat with a local fisherman. And she asks him, "So, how do you think the pyramids were built?" And he says, "Well, we've had the story passed down throughout generations. Everybody knows the story that the way that they moved the stones wasn't on boats like this, because it would just crush it; it would sink." It was actually they'd just tap the stone with a wand and it would levitate and we'd float those along and walk them to the pyramids. And the lady's like, "What?" You know, just freaking out kind of stuff. And it's like, yeah. Oh, well, I suppose your explanation of like tens of thousands of slaves and stuff like that being able to move masses that are thousands of times them. I mean, like, even if ants that can move 10 times their body weight were translated to humans and you had tens of thousands of slaves, you still wouldn't be able to do it.
Yeah, and that's not even speaking to the mathematical and musical tonality perfection of the way they built the interior of the pyramid, the king's mm-hmm. chamber, and the resonance of the way that the structures and the tunnels that funnel through the major pyramid of Giza are set up the way that they are. They would have initiates sit in water, and as we all know, cymatics and acoustics vibrate through water more than any other medium, and we're, what, 80% water? A human being, a vessel, is mostly water anyway. They would have these initiates sit in these bathtubs on any kinds of strange concoction of psychedelics, DMT or whatever, and they would lay in the king's chamber and try to project themselves to a sort of telephone communication with the gods or those that came from the stars. And then he thought that that was one of the primary purposes of the pyramids, was to connect human beings with those that came before, those that made us, Prometheus style.
Mm-hmm. And there's also been a number of pyramid experiments. I believe it was either David Wilcock or Ian R. Crane did a presentation that I went to, and they've built this plastic pyramid in Russia. And the amount of amazing things that they've been able to discover, like if you give a milliliter of water that's been sat in that pyramid to a hemophiliac baby, the baby gets cured of its hemophilia.
Wow!
If you have rats that have tumors and you put them in the pyramid, their tumors go away, and all these other really amazing phenomenon. And the reason why it's plastic is because if it's metal, it doesn't work at all. And then you start to realize that, oh my God, did you realize that there are pyramids all over the earth? There's pyramids in China, there's pyramids in Bosnia and Egypt and Africa and South America, and the entire planet is literally covered in these fracking pyramids.
Yeah. And how did we learn of these strange technologies as children? One of the topics that Ezra and I cover in Music Myth Cosmos is we're the 80s generation. We grew up on video games. And what's the number one most popular video game of all time? Super Mario Brothers. And it's about these Italian plumbers. First of all, it's a Japanese-based game, like this oriented and originated from Japan. It's about these two Italian plumbers that take these psychedelic compounds, mushrooms, to gain powers, to grow in size and everything else. And one of the main aesthetic values of the game is that there's teleportation and Stargate aesthetics throughout the whole game that pertain directly to the ancient Egyptian pyramids. There's pyramids in all portions and sections of the game. And there's resonances of star travel and Stargate opening through musical devices throughout that game and many other games of that nature.
Mm-hmm. And we have one of the things we point out in the video is that that game Zelda, you know, so you have Mario and Zelda, two of the biggest video game icons of our generation, and both of them not only have warp whistles or the Ocarina of Time, which are basically essentially the same idea, but they also literally use the same melody. I mean, to the note and the same musical notes. If you watch the video, you'll be able to see. But This is maybe irrelevant for somebody who's not already inundated in that culture and who didn't grow up with it and hasn't been imprinted by it. And yet it's still relevant as a cultural signifier that there is this deep undercurrent of awareness, understanding on the part of anybody who's seen these videos that music and magic are just a hairline fracture difference. The main difference is that magic, you can't really prove that it exists. It's all illusion. We're these like reductionist, materialist, scientific, belief systems. That's what we've been given, and we're like totally bought into that. And if it doesn't fit into that, that we won't buy in. And so when we see magic, we know, oh, it's just a stage trick. But if we hear music, well, we know that it's just a musician playing the notes, but it still affects us emotionally, just like a stage trick would. And so the whole thing of like, yeah, is music literally able to open up dimensional portals? Well, I think that it could be so, and I think Steve is of the same opinion. But even if that were not the case, even if there's just no way that's ever possible, it doesn't change the fact that our consciousness has been inundated with the symbology of music as a magical trigger, and that the fact that music is one of the primary culture generators of our world.
I'd even go as far as that metaphorically music is what is ingrained in children to take their creative spirit into realms of the unknown, to take it to the furthest possible state. And maybe what a lot of yogis use in their meditation is formed when they're children, when they hear these musical Stargate symbols in their head, and they realize when they're a child for the first time that anything is literally possible, that they can create anything. I think music is a catalyst for that, and I think that's the key of all of these magical practices, is that it can open up the creative stargates within your own mind, and therefore, scientifically and in the real world, pragmatically, can open up all kinds of breakthroughs in medicine and science and travel and anything else you could possibly imagine.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, a lot of the really massive bands and cultural icons of the 60s, when this new age counter-revolution sort of started to happen, were all children of military intelligence people.
Yeah. the general
I'm just thinking about this.
Yeah, the Doors and Jim Morrison and the story of his father as an admiral. It's really a lot of that stuff's really intense. I agree.
Oh yeah, and we did a good discussion with Jan Irvin and Joseph Atwell. I think it was last week or the week before about the 60s counterculture and acid culture, literally being created and fostered by the CIA in order to control the culture and force it down a particular path. And you know, you see what happened, came out of there, like feminism and the breakdown of the nuclear family, the Rockefeller family. Foundation funded it, and now, hey, if you're a man or a woman, you can be taxed now, and you both have to work because the wages have been halved. So who's home to take care of the kids? Nobody.
What about
and you've got to spend your money paying somebody else who doesn't even have any familiarity with your kids to take care of them, because otherwise they wouldn't have anybody to look after them whatsoever, because you've got no family background and no grandparents to look after them, because everybody's gotten the frack apart from them because of divorce.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And look at the very powerful undercurrent that happened in the Laurel Canyon scene in the 60s as well. You had a very, very strong Luciferian current in music and bands that were associated with a very honest, 1950s Pleasantville type mentality, like the Beach Boys. And like that was a real thing with the Manson murders and the Sharon Tate murder. And all those things had this sort of devilish Luciferian vibe to it. Yet the music itself on the surface was incredibly G-rated for kids.
Right. I just want to jump in there and clarify the history of that. So there was this guy, Dennis Wilson, who was the drummer of the Beach Boys. And he had just been driving and Charlie Manson was hitchhiking. And they got affiliated. And pretty soon Charlie came over. He actually broke into Dennis Wilson's house. But then brought like 7 or 8. Of his girls, and they were all naked. So when Dennis showed up at his house, there was Charlie Manson with 8 naked women, and they were all ready to have this orgy. And so they used sex and they used music in order to affect Dennis Wilson, who was then able to actually bring Charlie Manson's music into the Beach Boys. And that happened. There's a song called Cease to Exist, which was translated as a Beach Boys song called Never Learn to Love. But it's an example of how you have this Luciferian character, Charlie Manson, who was able to affect the music industry and who had this influence on Sharon Tate, who was associated with a famous filmmaker, Roman Polanski, and so forth.
The most powerful icon that I've seen in film in my life that tied music and sex magic together was Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. If you remember, remember they had that large Masonic ballroom party at the end of the towards the end of the movie, where they had these like reverse keys that were very subtly minor, and they had all these people wearing masks in this very occult OTO like magical fashion, and they would play these keys in a certain way and go around in a circle almost like a zodiac, where these masked naked women were standing around in a circle around the Grand Meister, like that was dressed in all red. He could be the Prime Minister, he could be the President. In some respects, metaphorically, he represents like Obama or, you know, the Queen and like, you know, the most powerful icon sitting at the middle. And they were using this magical ketone with masks as a way to disguise themselves in a magical sex ritual. So I think that, just speaking to Ezra's point, that those things are tied together in a very significant way in upper echelons of government and the elite as well.
Indeed. And we'll be right back after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, my very special guests, Steve Wilner and Ezra Zera. Or Beelzebub, as he's commonly known. We'll be right back. Gentlemen, kicking it, rocking it, in it. On the Vinnie Eastwood Show with my very special guests, Steve Wilner and Ezra Zera, otherwise known as Beelzebub. And their website is tonecoloralchemy.com and indiegogo.com. I think, I'm not sure if it's /, but anyway, Music Myth Cosmos is the ones there. And they've got lots of videos and things of that nature at youtube.com/soundlessdawn. That's Soundless Dawn, as in a dawn without any sound. You know what I'm saying? Pretty straightforward. And labyrinthofthepsychonaut.blogspot.com is their blog. That's Labyrinth of the Psychonaut, which I believe... No, I don't have any belief structure on that, actually. What is the Psychonaut exactly?
A psychonaut is somebody that explores the furthest reaches of experience to try to find out the original meaning of what it is to be alive and breathing.
Righto. Astronaut, the explorer of space. Chrononaut,
it's the explorer
of time. And the psychonaut is the explorer of the mind.
It's certainly been associated with people that use psychoactives to try to find the root of their being, of why it is that they are alive. But that's not the only definition. It's just one of them.
Yeah. Well, if you think about our society and who runs it, I think there is a lot of psychos that are active out there.
Right. So I guess we're not psychos, too. We're psychonaut.
You ever been criticized?
Now, article is also the exploration of sea, the last frontier, you know? It's going...
Yeah. See, I want
to put out there,
a child for being a bit psycho-naughty.
Getting psycho-naughty. That's funny.
Sorry, guys, you're breaking up.
The name, actually, it also came out of, there's a guy, Peter J. Carroll, who's a chaos magician. Okay.
Yeah, I know, I can hear you fine. Can you hear? Fine now. It's just, okay, yeah. You're just kind of like breaking up just a little bit, you know, like how somebody kind of, you know how when people are possessed by demons, they start to speak in tongues and something like that? When people are possessed by Skype, they start speaking in sort of like this Cybertronian Transformer type voice, you know, like, you know, I call it the Megatron effect.
Are you upset with talking with Cybertronic Transformers, because we transform every once in a while into those vehicles.
Yeah,
that's okay.
Yeah, well, as long as it's got the flames down the side, you know, it's all G unit.
Yeah.
Oh well.
All right, well, Vinny, what else do you want to talk about for the rest of the hour?
Well, you know, my show is actually about what my guest wants to talk about. Whatever I want to talk about is basically irrelevant by comparison, because I've got 5 days a week to say whatever I want to say, whereas you guys only have right now in the next 8 minutes.
That's true.
Okay. Well, I don't know if there's something you want to speak to. I know that there's something alive for me.
Sure.
One of the teachings that's come through, there's a guy named Jocelyn Godwin, who's a professor at Colgate University in England. And he's written a bunch of books on, he wrote a really famous one called Music.
Whoa. Did you say Colgate University as in the toothpaste university?
Yeah, I think it might be sponsored by them or something, or not. I don't know. But that, yeah, that's how it's spelled, Colgate. Yeah.
I can't anyway, guarantee you that the professors are big advocates of fluoride. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, the guy who I'm talking about, he's not at all affiliated. He's actually basically a conspiracy literature author who he's written about like Nazi UFO projects. But his main focus is actually not at all conspiratorial in the realm of politics. He's more into music mysticism, and so he and I have had this, we've had some one-on-one dialogues, and I have a really strong affinity with him. He's one of the only authors who's written about this topic in depth, and because he speaks German, and he speaks Latin, he speaks French, he speaks English, he's able to translate all these different ancient texts into English, which is really a benefit for me as somebody who's researching this stuff. And so anyway, there's, you know, he's come out with all these different books, but one of them in particular has been a real inspiration for this upcoming video documentary that we're promoting. And it's called like the Music and Cosmos, or the Cosmic Music. That's what it was. And I found this book after we started Music Myth Cosmos. It was a really beautiful synchronicity. And one of the things he does is he translates these three German authors, their central works into English. And he talks about the different theoretical sources of music. And I just wanted to bring that up while we still have a few minutes, because I think it's a really beautiful in route into what we're really trying to get at with our message and with our signal. So here it is. The story is that our soul is basically light. It emanates from our sun. And the sun, as it like sends out these cosmic rays, it reaches our planet. This sun ray comes into the earth, and over a period of time, it matures into a human organism, a baby. And that baby, the soul, is actually an expression of the fire of the sun, which in turn is just an expression of this cosmic energy that radiates through the whole universe. And in the process of traveling from the sun towards the earth, it passes through these various spheres of influence. Now, another theory is that the soul doesn't travel from our sun, but our soul actually travels from one solar system to another. So we're not just trapped in this solar system. And so if our soul has traveled at a certain point from another solar system into this one, we have to travel through the spheres. And the spheres are a symbolic representation of the various orbital patterns of our planet. So all the way from the outer reaches, you know, the plutonic belt of a plutoid comet sort of things. You have Uranus and Neptune, you have Saturn and Jupiter, you have, and then you have at the inner sphere, you have basically the sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. And so it passes through these various spheres of influence, each of which the orbital pattern is defining this sort of mathematical frequency, this resonant field that's affecting our soul vibration as we travel through here. So we come into human existence with a previous soul imprint of our planets. And so that's one of the core understandings when we're entering into the understanding of cosmic music and of classical music, of the ancient music, that will help us to clarify where the sounds that we're hearing today on the radio and on TV, where all that stuff comes from, the roots of this belief that there's a spiritual travel that happens for the soul when we reach this planet, and eventually that our soul is going to be liberated again.
A pragmatic way to look at it, Vinny, if you're a beginner to cosmology and the link between music and cosmology, are things like orbital patterns. Mercury has an 88-day orbital pattern around the sun, and there are 88 keys on the piano. So there are things that are very specific that we actually can directly correlate music to the spheres in the heavens. And it's not a coincidence, because the people that are creating the 12-tone systems and are creating the Western tonality system, we're doing it so for the church, and we're greatly inspired by the heavens, if not only inspired by the heavens, to create their systems of management for language and music.
Right. Also, Mercury, the planet Mercury, which is the closest planet to the sun, has been sometimes seen as the moon of the sun, or the reflective surface that mirrors back the cosmic energies emitting from the sun. And a cool thing, if you look at the Hermetic alchemical tradition, Hermes, who's the god of knowledge, of music, of communication, Hermes is equated to the planet Mercury. Mercury and Hermes in Thoth, these were all the names of the same esoteric organism, which was corresponding to this planet. And that 88-day cycle, which corresponds to the 88-tone keyboard, interestingly enough, also corresponds to the idea that we write music down on a staff. Sheet music or a staff music, we put these tones or these notes, we project onto the staff. So it just brings me back to what you spoke about earlier, that you just tap with a magical wand or the magical staff on this pyramidical block and it'll levitate. Well, what about the idea that what you're tapping, that staff, is not with literally a rod, but it's with the rod of music. It's with the musical hermetic staff.
Or if it's an advanced piece of technology that actually manipulates the frequencies upon contact and infects whatever it is with that levitation, you know. And I would like to see this in my lifetime, actually, you know, come back into the use, because there's too much evidence to ignore that previous civilizations that through massive cataclysm in the Earth's history were completely wiped out and we lost all their technology. And archaeologists have been screaming about this for years, and they get called crazy conspiracy theorists and insane believers or whatever, when they've got real physical evidence of the existence of more advanced technology that the ancients have possessed and used on a daily basis that is way better than whatever we've got today. You know, we've got Skype. Hey, they can lift 200-ton stones, bro.
If you look at the etymology of where we're coming from, the sort of pop culture research that we do stem from something called synchromysticism, which is finding like these meaningful nuggets of syntax in very mundane or ordinary media, everyday life, the most simplest of situations imaginable. If you can take that and see how many different narratives could be formed from the simplest of equations. And we take things, even biblical things, we could relate to music. If we do it in a free associative jazz-like style, we've looked at Moses and how he parts the Red Sea, and how we talked about cymatics and how music affects water as a variable, as the biggest medium. So Moses parting the Red Sea could also be Middle Sea. He's making a part between the waters. So I guess what I'm saying is that the syntax, as relevant as it might be to the individual, can also be very meaningful if thousands of people can agree upon it.
All right. Well, guys, we've come to the end of the show. I hope this has been enjoyable. In fact, I know that this has been enjoyable for you. I'm glad that I've been able to give you some levity and a little bit of fun, a little bit of coverage. And I want people to go to these websites if it's your forte, okay? For some people, a man in a pharaoh's headdress is a little bit much. But you can go to tonecoloralchemy.com. And check out a little bit more of the stuff, as well as indiegogo.com/projects/music-myth-cosmos. Guys, thank you very much. And we'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.